The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Fast away, good afternoon. Welcome to Man in Line on Manx Radio. It's your chance to have your say. And today, the Justice and Home Affairs Minister, Jane Paul Wilson, MHK, is on with Chief Officer Dan Davis from the department. So whatever it is that comes within their portfolio, as it were, you can have a chat, have a quiz, and get to the bottom of things. Constabulary, fire and rescue, prison, probation, anti-money laundering, licensing, police complaints, hate speech, hate crimes, road safety, it's all on between now and 1 o'clock today. So, Fast Mike, good afternoon, Jane Paul Wilson and Dan Davis.
Good afternoon, Andy.
Well, good to see you. So let's dive straight in, Jane. This one is from Wolf, who drops a note in to say, as the Minister's portfolio includes road safety, could I ask, each year during the TT and MGP, we see signs and broadcasts with a theme, Know Your Limits, issued by the Road Safety Committee. So I just wanted, the first question is, who makes up the Road Safety Committee? The second one is, the Wolf says, there are many car and motorcycle clubs on the Isle of Man with one umbrella group representing most of the clubs. And none of the people I've spoken to has a clue who sits on the Road Safety Committee and know what they do for road safety other than the TT. I and several other people feel that speed appears to be their only interest, that is for the two times of the year, apart from the DOI's obsession with 20 miles per hour. The Institute of Advanced Motorists Isle of Man Group is disbanded. Now, we have many serious road safety issues being ignored, such as blind junctions, often restricted by hedgerow growth, not cut back. Just one more of many in winter, vehicles, particularly on the mountain, flying amongst us with no lights or defective lights, and nobody seems to bother. We really do need a system where government and its quangos consult effectively with the people and perhaps broaden the representation of those on the Road Safety Committee to include representatives from car and motorcycle groups. Jane Paul Wilson.
Yes, a lot there, actually. Thanks for all of that, Wolf. I think the critical point is he's absolutely right. It has to be a partnership approach. And the road safety strategy that's currently in play, I think it runs out to 2029, adopts the safer systems approach, which is all about really what do we do to reduce the incidence of particularly killed and seriously injured on our roads. But more recently, we are also tracking the number of injuries in any event, because we recognise that there's a degree of obviously impact for people with injuries. So we have a road safety strategic group and we have a road safety partnership sitting beneath that, and the partnership is more operational, if you like, and it is a collaboration. It's who you would expect. So there is obviously representation from the constabulary and the Department of Home Affairs, but crucially there's also the Department of Infrastructure. I think the point about consultation and engagement is absolutely valid. To some of the points, just thinking about what Wolf raised around maintenance of our hedges and safety and so on. I know that the DOI has responsibility in terms of our highways, and then some of that and our main thoroughfares, as you like, our main routes for that sort of hedgerow maintenance and so on. Some of it is local authority level, but I think he's absolutely right. You know, the way to be most effective, particularly when we have to make our resources stretch as far as we can, is to try and make sure that the right people are doing the right jobs and prioritising what will have most impact. But Dan, I know, is involved in the Road Safety Strategic Group, so he might want to talk a little bit more about how all of that interacts in practice.
Yeah, and the partnership group takes an evidence-based approach. So if you look at where the majority of the killed and seriously injured incidents have been in our roads, it's been primarily on the mountain road, and there's often a spike during motorsport periods. And I'm really pleased to say that it's now 4 years since we have had a fatal incident during a motorsport event from a member of the public, which I think is a tribute really to the police, the fire and rescue service, the ambulance service, colleagues in the Department of Infrastructure who sit together to try and bring together a road safety campaign each year to try and reduce the number of serious and fatal incidents on our roads, particularly during racing times. But the Minister's right, road safety applies throughout the year, and it'd be great if people want to get in touch and share where they think we should focus our priorities. We do try and take an evidence-based approach, and I think people also should get in touch with their local authorities. They get in touch with the Department of Infrastructure, who've got a report a problem app. So if they see specific issues around things like, you know, if they're noticing people aren't turning the lights on over the mountain during autumn and winter, get in touch with the DOI, speak to the constabulary, and the constabulary are really good at responding to public concerns and doing some proactive response policing. So you'll see during the evenings, for example, as the nights draw in, you'll start to see DOI and constabulary colleagues by the side of the road stopping vehicles for proactive checks to look at their lights, look at their tyres to make sure that the vehicle's in a safe condition. So there is a lot of work that goes on beyond those 4 weeks of the year.
Okay, who's on the Road Safety Committee?
So the partnership group is, as the Minister said, it's the Department of Infrastructure, it's the police, the Fire and Rescue Service, the Ambulance Service, Department of Education. We've got public health colleagues in there, and they take the partnership group and they look at the statistics around things like killed and seriously injured, and they plan road safety campaigns. And then there's a strategic group which sits above that, which I chair, and again there are representatives from all the different agencies across government, and we look at the overall progress towards the road safety strategy.
Okay, is there a shorthand way of remembering who's responsible for what? So if you see a 20 mile per hour sign hidden behind a hedge, is that generally the local authority? Would it be DOI? If there's a road sign that's absolutely obscured by moss and lichen, is that DOI?
I think get in touch with the DOI in the first instance. So if it's a road sign and the road sign's obscured, then they can look at it and work out what needs to be done with that. But the DOI's report a problem website or app is really good for that. And the DOI are really responsive on that.
Okay, a message in there. Oh, this is especially for Jane Paul Wilson. Will Jane Paul Wilson be supporting Stu Peters' motion for the public to have their say in a binding referendum on net zero?
Oh, okay. I think this is his referendum for the Tynwald, December Tynwald. I think the issue is that I'm a member of Council of Ministers, and the government will consider any motion that comes forward by a backbencher, and you know there will want to be a government response. So I don't want to preempt the government's consideration of motions that are coming forward to future sittings of Tynwald.
Okay, and this is in from it's Amy who just said we've heard about problems with drugs. In fact, G.E. Whites will tell you the best selling paper on the Isle of Man is the Daily Mail, and I don't know whether you've seen this big splash in the Daily Mail about the Isle of Man getting, well, according to them, swamped with Liverpool drug gangs. So, we'll address that. Amy just said, how big a problem are drugs coming from Liverpool, in particular ketamine?
So, definitely we've had reports that there has been an increase in ketamine. We've heard that from different sources. More broadly, in terms of drugs and drug gangs and serious and organised criminals targeting the island, we became aware of this, and, you know, we have reported, the Chief Constable has reported this in his last few annual reports, and listeners may be aware that part of our response to tackling the harms associated with serious and organised crime seeking to target the island was the launch of our Securing Our Island strategy, which happened last year. We've made a lot of progress on that in the interim, and I think, you know, one of the ironies in all of this is as you have success in tackling a problem, you see more reporting of the numbers of people being stopped and the amount of cash and drugs being intercepted to the island. So that work remains ongoing. We're in the course of having refreshed that Securing Our Island strategy, but You know, the aim really is to maintain the security of the island and reduce the harm and impact from people who would seek to bring criminality and all the associated harm that goes with that.
I mean, the Daily Mail made much of the fact that the prison's full. The prison's full because the Chief Constable and his staff have been doing their job.
So the and it's a combination of things. They have been doing their job, absolutely. They've been doing their job around tackling serious and organised crime, but also, and we may come on to this today, in the last administration, some significant new legislation was passed, Domestic Abuse Act and the Sexual Offences and Obscene Publications Act. And what we have seen is with new legislation that targets particular types of offending, once that is there, that will also see an increase in the number of people being investigated and then successfully prosecuted. And again, our prison, the population that is imprisoned around sexual offending has definitely gone up. So the Chief Constable's been doing their job, but also we have introduced laws and protections for people that are effectively being enforced.
Dan Davis?
I think there was a phrase once, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. And I think the article highlighted the scale of the issue, but didn't really highlight the scale of the response. And I think, as the Minister said, the Chief Constable has been extremely proactive. The Ports policing team have now come into the department and sit underneath the constabulary. The customs and immigration team work really closely with the constabulary, and they're taking a very proactive, intelligence-led approach to policing. And the Daily Mail article had a number of pictures of people who have been arrested and been put in prison. And ultimately, the Chief Constable says, and he's right, that this is a risk-reward issue. So the harder it is for people to come here, the rewards have to be higher. And what he wants to do is redress the balance to make sure that it is really difficult for people to bring drugs into the island. And that's happening, and we can see that, and we can see the number of people who are prosecuted. But let's be really, really clear that, you know, with drugs come criminality. So anybody who buys drugs is contributing to criminality. And criminality brings violence, it brings exploitation. And that's right through the chain of drug supply. So, you know, the cocaine that comes from South America, that is based on a production line of exploitation, of violence, of slavery. And that perpetuates right through the chain to local drug dealers who will extract violence when they need to settle a debt, for example. So, you know, there isn't a good drug or a lower drug that brings less violence. You know, there is violence associated and criminality with every single part of the drug supply chain.
Okay, is there a permanent drugs dog at the ports?
There are four.
Yes. So, you know, with the Securing Our Island strategy, you know, a lot of it was practical, operational impact and change. So that's the dogs units, the dogs being part of the response at the ports. It's also the, as Dan referenced, the merger of ports policing within the constabulary, which took effect in February. It's the proactive engagement cross-agency, including with customs and immigration. It's the fact that we brought forward legislation earlier this year to introduce automatic number plate recognition at the ports, which has become initially operational. It's the intelligence work that's conducted with places like the National Crime Agency and the Northwest Regional Organised Crime Group. So there's a huge amount that has been done. And as I say, we are looking again at where we need to refresh and target and prioritise moving forward.
Okay, we'll get to the phones in a moment, but this is from 496. Could you ask Jane Paul Wilson why there's no requirement to provide ID when travelling to the Isle of Man on the boat? Secondly, what data does the DHA hold regarding the number of people who travel here by boat versus the number who leave? I'm trying to establish if data exists for those who travel here then stay legally or not, says Rachel.
Yeah, so there is, Rachel's right, there's no legal requirement for people to show ID. One of the aspects of the Securing Our Island strategy I referenced was we wanted to work more closely with carriers, which would include the steam packet, to actually make sure we've got verified information about passenger right. manifests. So what the police have always done, I think, and are now even more effective at, is accessing travelling passenger information on an intelligence-led basis so that they can deal with criminality. But what has been a problem, I guess, is that the steam packet stopped taking cash payments earlier this year, because then anyone can rock up and pay cash and get on the boat.
Right.
Now, there will be a record of you having booked. One of the challenges is to make sure that that is verified information, so we know that the person is who they say they are. The other part of it is that we want to bring forward some legislation that gives us an underpinning for the use of facial recognition technology, automatic facial recognition technology, because where there are known wanted people travelling backwards and forwards and they're on a watch list, one of the most effective ways in which we could identify anybody like that who was travelling to or from the island would be through that automated recognition piece that would automatically flag up that someone who is a known wanted person is moving to and from the island, and that would allow us to intercept and deal with the harm rather than targeting people on a widespread basis, as
so
it were.
At the moment, does the constabulary have access to the passenger manifest?
Yes.
Okay. And secondly, a question in from Brian, who just says, who does the security at Heacham?
So the steam packet have their own contracted staff at Heacham, and obviously, as I alluded to before, the constabulary here do work very closely with relevant forces, right, and the National Crime Agency in the UK
and in Liverpool.
Okay, all right, David, you're live with the Minister for Home Affairs and Justice, Jane Paul Wilson.
Hi, Andy. I just want to quickly ask, and I think the Minister's already answered some of the questions, is number plate recognition and face recognition. You know, how far are we away for operating it? I think she probably said we've got the number plate going, which is good. And there's only three parts to the question, really. Is the other one I want to find out about too, and she can come back on the air and we'll let the other people get on, is community service. What's happening with community service? Because I've been emailing them and saying that they can't do some of it because there's nobody to look after them. So there's no officer anymore to look after the community service. So we're missing out on those people that want some help and support in the community. What's happening?
Okay. So thanks, David. On ANPR, as I said, the legislation's in place and the rollout has begun. There are different phases of the rollout of ANPR, but it has definitely in place and able to be used in phase one. Facial recognition, we need primary legislation to underpin the use of that in the future. So our aim, and I'm hoping to come to Tynwald in October with the department's plan for the last year of this administration, and you will be able to see in that one of the pieces of legislation is designed to be consulted on and to move through the branches to give us that underpinning legislation to be able to make use of facial recognition. So I can't say when we would use it yet, because it's dependent on getting that primary legislation through. And the final one, David, about community service. Yes, I mean, Dan no doubt will want to contribute to this as well, but it is interesting that when we want to run community service for many of the people who might be serving a community sentence, weekends are quite an important time to be able to do that service. And one of the challenges we've had is the volunteer base to support that delivery. But we have made progress and got some more people in place to be able to support that. There's another brilliant piece of work that we're working with Destination First, who I think are collaborating with different agencies and departments across the island and local authorities to look at, you know, how we can do more around some of the, we alluded to signs, for example, you know, cleaning things up, tidying, making things better. And so we are collaborating with Destination First and the prison, as well as the probation service, to also look at how volunteers who might work as part of Destination First might also be interested in supporting community sentences and community service. So there is progress being made, David. It's something I'm very passionate about and would like to see us really do more on.
Okay, Dan Davis?
Yeah, it has been a challenge trying to find people who want to work on a Sunday to supervise community offenders, but the community service is still ongoing. We are doing a number of services, community service sentences in the community. We recognise it's not as, there aren't as many colleagues there to support and supervise as we'd like. But
do
we
they
are
have to be from within the department?
No, we're looking at a whole range of options. They don't have to be from within the department, but we're looking at a volunteer base as well. To try and broaden the number of people who can oversee community service. It's all done on a risk basis, Andy.
Okay, but obviously it has to be said there are many people who have strayed off the path and are in the prison because they made some bad choices. They're not intrinsically wicked people, you know, like drug dealers or people like that. They are people who've just had a bit of a problem. And part of prison is rehabilitation and probation and getting those people back into society. And community services, it is one of the ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. Restorative justice, community sentences. I think that if you look at the criminal justice strategy, it sets out an aspiration that people shouldn't go to prison for sentences of less than a year unless it's a serious or sexual or violent offence. And I think the department and the minister can confirm that from a political perspective is really committed to doing that. And I think you need a whole range of different infrastructure in place. But where people don't go to prison and maybe they have a disposal like a tag, they can continue with their lives. They can go back to work. They can keep their housing. They can keep their family. And these are all what the probation service called protective factors, and they support people in reducing their offending and contributing back to society. And I think we are really keen to see that. And the number of people in prison with mental health issues, with drug and alcohol addiction issues is really quite significant. And I think there's a huge opportunity for us to really grasp the bull by the horns here and transform the way that we support people who have offended.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I would support that prison is reserved for the most serious and violent offending. But, you know, as well as redress to society for the offending, the other part is absolutely the opportunity to rehabilitate and so on. And done well, that can be done effectively in the community as well as in a prison environment.
Okay, David?
Good news. Well done. 5-star. Leave it with you.
All right. Bye. Thanks for calling today. Good to hear from you. Prisoners that aren't Manx born, can they be returned to the UK immediately? As we're not why are we responsible for the day-to-day cost of keeping them at the prison?
So we do liaise with the UK Prison and Probation Service around what are known as prisoner transfers. I suppose there's two things here. You know, if you've committed an offence and you're arrested and tried here and sentenced here, then you will go, if it's a prison sentence, you will be sent to prison here. What people may also see is that the courts can also impose an exclusion order, excluding people from the Isle of Man for up to 5 years, which would typically be delayed until after the sentence has been served. But once people are in the prison here, if it is appropriate for us to try and seek for them to be transferred to the UK, then that liaison does take place. Obviously, it's well publicised that the prison system in the UK has been under significant strain. So we can't just move people. It has to be part of a discussion and a managed process.
That it may be that our sentence is stiffer than the one that they would get in the UK.
Correct.
Okay, Dan Davis?
And just in terms of that phrase, Manx born, I think it's about people who have no connection here, because somebody may have been born in the UK but moved here when they were 10 and they have a whole family and connection here. And so the piece of legislation around exclusion is very specific around who's got connection to the island and who hasn't.
Okay, we're live with Justice and Home Affairs today. The Minister, Jane Paul Wilson, MHK, Chief Officer Dan Davis, here till 1 o'clock on Man in Line.
Hi, Liz. I see you've had your garage converted. We're desperate for more room.
Yes, come through and have a look. John called Manx Property Conversions. We now have an extra bedroom, but it could be another reception room, kids' playroom or office. They also did our conservatory roof last year. We were so impressed, we got them back to convert the garage.
Wow, I need that. What's their number again?
Call MPC on 450500. That's 450500. Or find them on Facebook at Manx Property Conversions.
Spectrum Windows. If your house needs a new look and your windows let in rain, keep those cold breezes out and make it look like new again. Spectrum Windows, Spectrum Windows. Quality through and through. Great work guaranteed to you. Spectrum Windows, Spectrum Windows. Spectrum Windows.
Ramsey Garden Centre. For roses, shrubs, climbers, trees and perennials. or solar lights, stone ornaments and bird baths. There's never been a better time to visit Ramsey Garden Centre. Open 7 days a week.
Whether starting a new business or building up your existing business, come and talk to the accounts and tax experts at Nicola Bowker & Co. With their holistic approach to business advice, Nicola Bowker & Co. will work with you to achieve success. For accounts that work, call 861-271.
Radio Caroline North is back on the air this weekend, and three lucky listeners will each win a quality Panasonic portable radio with FM and AM. That's the prize on offer in this month's competition. Our special guest broadcasters include Paul McKenna, so make a date to join us live aboard our historic radio ship, Ross Revenge. Our broadcast is sponsored by Turton Tower Woodland Cafe, and it's on Manx Radio, 1368 AM, online, on smart speakers and DAB, straight after Carnaby Street.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
29 minutes before one, and crikey, here's former MHK and Minister Chris Robertshaw on Man in Line. Hi, Chris, you're live with Justice and Home Affairs.
Andy, good afternoon to you. Jane, good afternoon, and Dan, hello.
Hello, Chris.
This question relates to the role of justice, as in Justice and Home Affairs Minister, which you and I recommended was created because of the, shall we say, the absence of justice focus. Now, everybody knows, it's a matter of history, that the AG's department hugely mishandled the Rosalind Ranson affair in relation to the Employment and Equalities Tribunal. Now, I would have thought, Jane, that you would have done a huge deep dive into the AG's department thereafter to find out what was going wrong. But in reality, since the Rosalind Ranson affair, the situation between the AG's and the Employment Tribunal has got worse. Namely, we have now two advocates who sit inside the AG's department, actually appointed by the Appointments Commission inside the AG's department. And then finally, we have the chairman of the AG's, of the Employment Tribunal, last month reporting on the AG's conduct on four cases before the Employment Tribunal, which effectively said, and I'm using my words rather than the chairman's report, that comments, that the AG's department was the equivalent, in political terms, of being bullying, aggressive, and making the life of those people trying to genuinely take their cases to the tribunal extremely difficult, such that one of the applications walked away. Now, all of this requires action. You don't seem to have done anything. In fact, the situation's getting worse, Jane.
Okay, all right. Well, let's bring the minister in then, Chris.
Okay, thanks, Andy. And Chris, you're absolutely right. We did make a recommendation that the justice piece was recognised in a ministerial portfolio. I think there's a few things I would say. First and foremost, that I thoroughly agree and maintain the position that the independence of our judiciary, which would include our tribunal system, is vital. The second thing I would say is, of course, there was the Wright review conducted by Casey Wright into what needed to be addressed, and those recommendations are moving forward. There were a number of detailed recommendations on the conduct of litigation, and those recommendations are being addressed. One of them, in fact, which was very important and was endorsed by the Constitutional Legal Affairs and Justice Committee and Tynwald recently, was that there should be a permanent judge appointed to the Employment and Equality Tribunal. And indeed, to take that forward, it was determined that there was an opportunity to reform more widely, and a consultation, a work on an implementation plan to bring forward the changes to deliver that was published at the end of June. And indeed, I hope that there will be a bill coming forward in the autumn to make the legislative change to enable the recruitment of that permanent judge to the Employment and Equality Tribunal and the wider tribunal service. I think to the point about managing conflicts, it is really, really important that we understand that where people sit on our tribunals, and there are a whole range of them, of course they may have prior knowledge or engagement with any of the cases that come before them, because the cases could be against a government department or body, but they could be against a private sector organisation. And in our small island, of course, there are going to be situations from time to time where either the one of the members who's on the panel for chairs of a tribunal, or who might be a lay member, should not sit on a particular case because they have some sort of connection with one of the parties. And so quite rightly, there is already provision for that not to happen. I think the difficulty with saying that no body can be involved in any tribunal, even when it is not anything to do with government, is in our small jurisdiction, we need people with expertise and knowledge of the relevant law to be able to be involved. So I think it's about the proper due process management of how the tribunals in individual cases are managed. But a significant change is coming to have a permanent judge to oversee our tribunal system.
Chris Robert Shaw?
Yes, I hear that long answer. Thank you for that, Jane. But you haven't answered the nub of the question at all. And the question was, how are you dealing with the over-aggressive conduct and behaviour of the Attorney General's office? I heard nothing in your answer.
There's another question coming on that from Texter 369, who just said, as the minister is legally qualified, how does she view the public statement by the Employment Tribunal chair on the AGs? And this is the texter's words: dirty tricks and gaslighting litigants in person as vexatious to discredit evidence and intimidation.
I think I'm sorry, Chris, I was talking about the right review and the conduct of litigation, and there were a number of recommendations that are being brought forward. I think if there is further work to do, then that is absolutely important that we continue to make sure that the conduct of litigation is done properly and appropriately. I should say this would be true for again, any person acting within either acting as a lawyer in any of our courts or presiding. If people's individual conduct in an individual matter is out with the professional standards expected of officers of the court or the judiciary, then those individuals their conduct should be addressed through the proper complaints processes.
Jane, with respect, you haven't answered the question about the over-aggressive behaviour of the AG's department. Your whole focus has been on the function of the Employment and Equality Tribunal. And you've said if there are problems, then they should be addressed. Well, they very clearly are there. What have you done about it?
There is the Employment Equality Tribunal, and there is the conduct of litigation. Most of Richard Wright's recommendations, and there were a large number of them, were around the conduct of litigation, and those are also being addressed.
Okay, all right, Chris, I'm sorry, we have to move on because we got lots more people on the phone, including Juan with us now. Hi, Juan, you're live with the Home Affairs and Justice Minister.
Thanks, Andy. Hi, Jane. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Juan.
Hi. I think we got the chocolate biscuits out for you, Dan. I'm sure Head and News is looking after you up there.
Can't comment.
No comment. just a few bits and bats. I have to agree with Chris on statement there from the feedback that I'm getting. The Attorney General's office is not working properly at the moment, and you've got an AG there who's waiting to retire, so things are a little bit all over the place.
Well, in theory, everybody's waiting to retire.
And you and me both, Andy. Just going on to some other points, and I've mentioned on this show before, one question I would ask you is, I mentioned this yesterday on religious head coverings, and this also ties up with your facial recognition. My point is, and I'd like your view on as a minister and also in your role, do you think religious facial head coverings should be accepted in the Isle of Man, or should the island the government do something right now before it gets too far that it can't, to stop this happening? Because my view is on facial recognition, And this would then be a rule for us and not for certain other people. That would be one thing. My other point is on digital ID. I'm not a fantastic lover of digital ID in where this is heading and where this could head. And as a constituency minister, your views on how that would be if there was a vote on digital ID.
Okay, Juan. First of all, I think with facial recognition, I mean, you know, I am not, I think we talked about this actually at the government roadshows from memory as well, but, you know, my expertise is not in the detail of the technology. I know there are different things, even face masks and so on, that have to be taken account of when you think about the effectiveness of the technology. So, you know, I think we have to recognise that the way in which that technology works, we do want it to be effective. So I would want to understand as well whether there are any factors such as whether it's head coverings or face masks that people have worn during COVID and so on, whether those, how they would affect the effectiveness of that technology in practice.
Okay, I think he's referring to full face coverings.
Yes.
Niqab and hijab.
Yes, and I think, yes, we do have to understand whether it's sufficient for eye recognition to do the job. So I'm not the technical expert, but it is something I would want to understand. Digital ID, we already, I think it was just over 18 months ago, we actually made provision as part of our licensing changes for digital ID to be accepted by retailers and outlets should they wish to do so. That is different, I guess, from a position where you say only digital ID is acceptable. But certainly I recognise, and we've had quite a lot of feedback actually into the department saying, can we force more people to accept digital ID because they would really like to use it and they would prefer it? So obviously we haven't mandated it, but we recognise that it is useful for some people, and so there is provision for it to be used in that particular context. I think a wider position on what forms of ID are acceptable for what purposes in the long run is obviously something that really needs to be thought about properly, Juan, with proper consultation as well in due course.
Okay, Dan Davis?
Yeah, I think the Labour Party, with the arrival of Shabana Mahmood as Home Secretary, know that there is probably going to be a discussion in the UK about digital ID. It's something I know Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister in the UK, is thinking about, and I know that Shabana Mahmood is seen as somebody who might push that forward. I think in the Isle of Man there is a huge amount of complexity around ID, the common travel area, and as the Minister said, any form of ID or verification would definitely need to be subject to huge public consultation and engagement.
Okay, thank you, Joan. Good to hear from you. Now from the answer phone.
Hi, Andy. It's Nick. Bit of a complaint. I'm just on my way to Douglas with my partner. She's driving, and we were behind a co-op lorry, which is no problem. Only in front of him was a cyclist, and then he got past the cyclist, and then there was another cyclist, and he got past him, and then there was another cyclist. We passed six cyclists between Ramsey Hairpin. Mayhill and the waterworks, who were just now actually on the move, and it's infuriating because we've just been across and we've been driving on the motorways in France and England and everything, and this basically from Ramsey to Douglas is basically a motorway when you can do 60 plus miles per hour, and it's a major thoroughfare from the north to the south. When you can do that speed and you've got cyclists on there, it's absolute danger to the cyclists, danger to oncoming traffic, anybody trying to pass or overtake. It's crazy. They shouldn't be allowed. They can take the coast road. There's plenty of other beautiful cycling routes to the south, or even, you know, anywhere around the island, but not the mountain. It's just dangerous. I've never called in about it until now. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. 70, 80 miles per hour. Some people do that on the mountain. It's absolutely insane. Anyway, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'm tempted to go to the cyclist first, but we'll go to the minister instead.
Yes, I mean, we do during motorsport periods actually say that cyclists, we don't want them to go on the mountain because of the increased issues that we have with the amount of traffic and how, there is that increased safety issue. I suppose, you know, it's not really a department position in terms of the highway code and how we on our roads, you know, I hear what Nick says about the speeds that people can go at on the mountain road. But like all our roads that are de-restricted, in effect, you know, you have to drive to the conditions and also bearing in mind the other road users. And as I understand it, under the highway code, you know, the vulnerable road user, whether pedestrian or cyclist, you know, that it, we do have to take account of it. But people will have very strong views one way or another, I'm sure, on this topic. But while the position remains as it is, there is nothing that prohibits people, and people who are driving do have to take due cognizance of more vulnerable road users.
Okay, Chief Officer is Dan Davis. It's a personal, you can ignore this if you want, Dan, but do you ever cycle across the mountain road?
Not frequently, no. It's a matter of risk, isn't it? And I think what is inevitable whenever there's a comment about cyclists on the mountain is just a huge amount of vitriol that pours in. And I think there's a hugely polarized position between cyclists and motorists, and I find it hard to understand. Everybody's human. You know, I've got 3 kids and a wife, and if somebody tries to overtake me in a dangerous way, it makes me afraid to cycle on the road. And I think sometimes motorists see cyclists as a huge irritation. I understand that, and sometimes cyclists can behave in a way which is absolutely contrary to the highway code. They shouldn't jump traffic lights. They shouldn't cycle on the pavement. They shouldn't, you know, overtake in dangerous places or ride, you know, in a huge peloton holding up the traffic. So I think if we could have a little bit more understanding on both sides, then perhaps we could get along a little bit better.
Okay. I mean, what would have to happen? I mean, Nick referred to it as the mountain motorway. What would have to happen for, what would be the process, Jane Paul Wilson, if somebody were to propose that?
It would be an order made by the Department of Infrastructure to designate the mountain road as a road on which cyclists can't travel. So it's down to the DOI and how the highway is designated and the vehicles that are prohibited from travelling under it.
Okay. I mean, is it safe for cyclists to ride on the mountain at night after dark?
Look, safety is subjective, isn't it? And it's a matter of you know, being lit up. Look, I've seen cars driving around with one headlight, or I've been overtaken in a 30 zone by a car that doesn't like the fact I'm doing 30 when I'm in a car. I think safety is about everybody respecting the rules of the road and you know, driving or riding to the conditions.
Okay, right, we're live with Justice and Home Affairs till one.
Have your say. The Council of Ministers has accepted a proposal for an offshore wind farm off the Isle of Man for examination. Take part in a public consultation and tell us what you think about the application from Moore Vannin Offshore Wind Farm Limited. Go online at mima.gov.im to find out more. You can also respond directly at consult.gov.im. If you prefer paper, collect and return response forms at Third Floor Government Offices, Bucks Road, Douglas. Read the application online and at Douglas City and Ramsey Town Libraries. The consultation closes at midnight, 18th of November. It's time to have your say.
Oh, I don't believe it!
Don't believe what?
A small stone just flew off the strimmer and shattered the conservatory window.
No problem. I'll call out Manx Glass and Glazing.
Oh, can they fix it?
Yes. Mum's glass shattered and they soon replaced it.
Manx Glass and Glazing don't just do the big jobs. Visit Snugborough Trading Estate for all your glazing supplies and repairs, including broken or failed double glazing units, along with good old-fashioned customer service and product knowledge.
Manx Glass and Glazing. You're smashing.
All right, Paul. You're looking relaxed. You finally booked that trip?
Yep, used some of the savings I locked in with Guernsey's Bank Skipton last year. Great interest rate and they made it so easy.
Oh, Skipton. I've been meaning to sort mine.
Do it. You'll get proper customer service too.
With market-leading savings rates and service that puts people first, Skipton International is here to help you feel secure, whatever you're saving for. For details on all of Skipton's savings products, call 01481 730 730 or visit skiptoninternational.com today. Skipton International is licensed to take deposits by the GFSC and is a participant in the Guernsey Banking Deposit Compensation Scheme, see dcs.gg.
Are you a small charity here on the Isle of Man? Are you looking for volunteers, hoping to raise awareness and chasing those crucial pounds and pennies to support your work? Well, Manx Radio can help. You could be our next 1-3 Charity of the Week. With daily on-air coverage, podcast and social media promotion, we can help support you and those you help. Just email the numbers 123@manxradio.com and listen out for the feature each weekday between 1 and 3pm. The Charity of the Week, brought to you by Kell Properties.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Jane Paul Wilson, MHK, and Dan Davis from Justice and Home Affairs. And John's with us. Hi, John, you're live with Home Affairs.
Hi, Andy. One day last week, my son, grandson and great-granddaughter went to Liverpool on a day trip. Going out of Douglas, they went through the normal checks, through the metal detector and all that, no problem. Coming back, well, in his words, the checks in Liverpool were virtually non-existent. They were just waved through. Now, during the day, my great-granddaughter had acquired a large, fluffy toy, and is what my son said. It could have been full of anything. But Liverpool, coming out, they don't seem worried. They just wave you through. So surely, you know, the system is that it's you check more going out of the island than you are coming in.
Okay, Jane Paul Wilson.
Thanks, John. And I think, I don't know if you heard earlier, my understanding is the steam packet contract their own staff at the ports in Liverpool and Heysham. One of the things, though, yes, we do check people, but there's also intelligence that is transferred to the constabulary. And there have been a number of interceptions and arrests with people arriving here. So they may not have been picked up, as it were, or prevented from travelling on the boat at the port when they were leaving, but they are intercepted here. However, you know, as part of our refresh of the Securing Our Island strategy, we are interested in looking at the deterrent and prevention elements as much as we can to see what we can do to prevent things even getting onto the boat. So, you know, take your experience and your feedback, which is helpful, and we will continue to look at what more we can do to try and prevent anything actually even getting on to our carriers.
Okay, John, do you feel safe on the Isle of Man?
Well, I was born here, and I suppose, yeah, compared with the UK, yes.
Okay, I'm just interested to know how you feel. All right, it's good to hear from you. Thanks for that. What can the Minister say about the Gold Team Police Security Briefing as to threat assessment for the forthcoming government conference? Will there be armed officers there again? Jane Paul Wilson.
So I think I talk a lot about the policy, legislation, strategy aspect of the department's work and my work, and the operational deployment work that goes on by the constabulary. And one of the reasons we have professionals and the chief constable and the relevant superintendents who lead on this work is they are the ones who have the day-to-day information and intelligence and can assess potential for threat and then determine how to deploy appropriately around that. So I wouldn't normally disclose operational detail. I would expect that a proportionate and sensible response is taken by the constabulary in relation to any potential threat, harm and risk.
Okay, the question of, and whenever we talk about security, from the other side is the question of overreach, if you like, state interference. How does the department balance the two?
I think it's a really, really interesting question. And one of my observations, one of my reflections over my time in Tynwald is that as people understand changing nature of threat and harm and risk, they are keen to see an appropriate response. But whatever our response is, it has to be done in consultation, and it has to be done in terms of, you know, what's the most effective and appropriate use of our resource to tackle the problems that we're dealing with in a way that society supports. And that's why our engagement and our consultation and discussion around some of these things, which are not necessarily straightforward to find a solution to, that's why it's so important.
Dan Davis?
And I think if you speak to the Chief Constable about the process he goes through on a quarterly basis at the department, where we have governance meetings where he's held to account for the delivery of the objectives set to him in the policing plan, his objectives in relation to things like the department plan, but also the range of powers that he has at his disposal, how they're deployed, and how he has used those powers. And the department asks for information on things like use of force, deployment of weapons, and the use of things like police bail. So if you speak to the chief constable, I think he'll say he's held to account in the same way for those use of powers as he would be when he was in West Yorkshire, for example. And in sometimes he says he's held to a greater scrutiny here because of the nature of the small island. And in a small community, it's really important that those powers have appropriate political oversight from the department. And in the same way in the prison and probation service, you know, the prison, I think being deprived of your liberty is probably the most fundamental thing we can do to anybody. And so the prison governor comes into the department once a quarter to update us on not only the things that are happening in the prison, but also how those powers that he has at his disposal have been deployed during that previous quarter.
Okay, well, talking to the prison, Tracy dropped a note in just to say, is it true you put planning in for a new wing at the prison?
We don't need planning permission at the prison for any buildings that are underneath a certain height, but I can say that we are looking at options for expanding the prison at the present time.
Okay. Jane Paul Wilson, on a political... Dan's talking about operational level. On a political level, is the Isle of Man now safer than it used to be?
Well, I think, you know, we saw a 10%... We've got a high crime detection rate, and the feedback we get is that people do feel safe. John mentioned it on air before, but the social attitude survey suggests that too. But we mustn't be complacent.
Okay. Thanks for being Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Andy.
And thanks to Jane Paul Wilson. We've been talking justice and home affairs today. And if you want to follow up on anything you've heard, you can call the answer phone on 682 631 or email maninline@manxradio.com. Back with another Open Line tomorrow. Thank you very much for tuning in today. The podcasts are going to be available fairly shortly. Thanks to Ben on the phones. Weather's not too good, but enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.